Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're basically at the end of what seems to be a long
hundreds of years.
It is hundreds of years away. So if we're not jaded in any way, we are. This is the little dollop of stuff on the top of our week, isn't it? Because we didn't think we would be able to make it, and here we are. So
yeah,
we're just going to sit down and have a bit of a nap, actually, I think. But I don't know where the last week
has
gone.
This is what is known as D-Mob happy.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Because once we finish with you guys, we get on Big Silver Bird and we kiss the floor of the BA compartment. Because it's taking us to England where they know that you don't make tea like you make coffee. And although every American in their head grasps this, in their hearts they don't. It has been fun. It always is fun, especially if you start with Seattle, because with no offense to you guys, I think Discworld Fan Center is right in the middle of Seattle, judging by the event we did there. There were so many young ladies who wanted to get near me. I was quite happy to get near them, but you know.
Some of them wore corsets. Some of them didn't.
Please don't. I'm an old man.
Would you like me to kick off and read a bit from Snuff?
Yes, let's read some Snuff.
Would you like to hear a bit from Snuff?
Yes.
There might be a little bit of introduction.
Okay, over to you. I would quite like to read the Crockett bit, if you don't mind, because it's my absolute favourite bit in the whole book. You okay with that?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Okay. Snuff is already out, so some of you quite likely have already read it. But Commander Vimes, familiar, I suspect, to most of you, is, shall we say, moved out of his natural environment, and especially out of his comfort zone. He's in the countryside. His family is with him, and he's supposed to be on holiday. Well, boys and girls, we all know what happens when a policeman goes on holiday. He's not going to have the time to get the shine off his bucket and spade before the first death. So, but this is a little bit of the preamble, because we rather like it. Over to you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Vimes is basically in a country pub, yeah, on Lady Sybil's.
Anyone here ever been in a British country pub? Especially for extra points in Somerset.
Yes.
Right, that's cider. Did you notice? Scrumpy. I used to live there. And where the blokes add more taste than brain cells. The Scrumpy used to rot your teeth. It really did. And it had lots of lead in it. So it actually did things to your brain as well. But oh, you never noticed, because I do. Yeah. Okay, well, we're in that kind of environment.
Okay, here we go. Vimes was becoming aware that the pub was filling up, mostly with other sons of the soil, but also with people who, whether they were gentlemen or not, would expect to be called so. They wore colourful caps and white trousers and spoke continuously. There was also further activity outside. Horses and carriages were filling the lane. Hammering was going on somewhere, and Jiminy's wife was now manning, or more correctly, womaning, the bar, while her husband ran back and forth with his tray. Jethro remained in his corner, like a man biding his time, occasionally glaring daggers, and probably fists as well, with an option on boots, if Vimes so much as looked at him. Vimes decided to take a look out of the grubby pub window. Regrettably, the pub was that most terrifying of things, picturesque, which meant that the window consisted of small, round panes fixed in place with lead. They were for letting the light in, not for looking out of, since they bent the light so erratically that it nearly broke. One pane showed what was probably a sheep, but which looked like a white whale until it moved when it became a mushroom. A man walked past with no head until he reached another pane and then had one enormous eyeball. Young Sam would have loved it, but his father decided to give eventual blindness a miss and stepped out into the sunshine. Ah, he thought, some kind of game. Oh well. Vimes wasn't keen on games because they led to crowds, and crowds led to work for coppers. But here, in fact, he wasn't a copper, was he? It was a strange feeling, so he left the pub and became an innocent bystander. He couldn't remember when he'd been one before. It felt vulnerable. He strolled over to the nearest man who was hammering some stakes into the ground and asked, "What's going on here then?" Realising that he'd spoken in copper rather than in an ordinary citizen, he added quickly, if you don't mind me asking. The man straightened up. He was one of the ones with the colourful caps. Haven't you seen the game of croquet, sir? It's the game of games. Mr. Civilian Vimes did his best to look like a man eager for more delicious information. Judging by his informant's enthusiastic grin, he was about to learn the rules of croquet, whether he wanted to or not. Well, he thought, I did ask. At first sight, sir, croquet might seem like just another ball game, wherein two sides strive against one another by endeavouring to propel the ball by hand or bat or other device into the opponent's goal of some sort. Croquet, however, was invented during a game of croquet at St. Onan's Theological College in Ham-on-Rye, when the novice priest Jackson Fieldfair, now the Bishop of Quirm, took his mallet in both hands and instead of giving the ball a gentle tap. After that, Vimes gave up. Not only because the rules of the game were incomprehensible in their own right, but also because this extremely enthusiastic young man allowed his enthusiasm to overtake any consideration of the need to explain things in some sensible order, which meant that the flood of information was continually punctuated by apologetic comments on the lines of, "Oh, I am sorry, I should have explained earlier that a second cone is not allowed more than once per exchange, and in normal play there's only one tump, unless, of course, we're talking about Royal Croquet." Vimes died. The sun dropped out of the sky. Giant lizards took over the world. The stars exploded and went out, and all hope vanished with a gurgle into the sink trap of oblivion. And gas filled the firmament and combusted, and behold, there was a new heaven, one careful owner, and a new disc, and lo, and possibly verily, life crawled out of the sea, or possibly didn't, because it had been made by the gods. That was really up to the bystander. And lizards turned into less scaly lizards, or possibly didn't. And lizards turned into birds, and worms turned into butterflies, and a species of apple turned into bananas, and possibly a kind of monkey fell out of a tree and realised that life was better when you didn't have to spend your time hanging on to something. And in only a few million years, evolved trousers and ornamental stripy hats, and lastly, the game of croquet. And there, magically reincarnated, was Vimes, a little dizzy, standing on the village green, looking into the smile countenance of an enthusiast.
It's not over. It's not over yet. There's more.
He managed to say, "Well, that's amazing. Thank you so very much. I look forward to enjoying the game." At which point, he thought a brisk walk home might be in order, only to be foiled by a regrettably familiar voice behind him saying, "You, yes, you, I say you, aren't you Vimes?" It was Lord Rust, usually of Ankh-Morpork, and a fierce old warhorse, without whose unique grasp of strategy and tactics, several wars would not have been so bloodily won. Now he was in a wheelchair, a newfangled variety pushed by a man whose life was, knowing his lordship, quite probably unbearable. But hatred tends not to have a long half-life, and in the recent years, Vimes had regarded the man as now no more than a titled idiot, rendered helpless by age, yet still possessed of an annoying, horsey voice that, suitably harnessed, might be used to saw down trees. Lord Rust was not a problem anymore. There were surely only a few more years to go before he would rust in peace. And somewhere in his knobbly heart, Vime still retained a slight admiration for the cantankerous old butcher, with his evergreen self-esteem and absolute readiness not to change his mind about anything at all. The old boy had reacted to the fact that Vimes, the hated policeman, was now a duke, and therefore a lot more knobby than he was, by simply assuming that this could not be possibly be true, and therefore by totally ignoring it. Lord Rust, in Vimes's book, was a dangerous buffoon, but, and here was the difficult bit, an incredibly, if suicidally, brave one. This would have been absolutely tickety-boo were it not for the suicides of those poor fools who followed him into battle. Witnesses had said that it was uncanny. Rust would gallop into the jaws of death at the head of his men and was never seen to flinch, yet arrows and morning stars always missed him, while invariably hitting the men right behind him. Bystanders, or rather the people peering at the battle from behind comfortably large rocks, had testified to this. Perhaps he was capable of ignoring too the arrows meant for him. But age could not be so easily upstaged, and the old man, while no less arrogant, had a sunken look. Rust most unusually smiled at Vimes and said, "First time I've seen you down here, Vimes. Is Sybil going back to her roots? What? She wants young Sam to get some mud on his boots, Rust. Well done her. What? It'll do the boy good to make a man of him. What?" Vimes never understood where the explosive "what" came from. After all, he thought, what's the point of just barking out, "what?" for absolutely no discernible reason? And as for, "what, what?" well, what was that all about? Why, what? What seemed to be tent pegs hammered into the conversation, but what the hell for, what? So, not down here on any official business then, what? Vimes' mind spun so quickly that Rust should have heard the wheels go round. It analysed the tone of voice, the look of the man, that slight, ever so slight, but nevertheless perceptible hint of a hope that the answer might be a no, and presented him with a suggestion that it might not be a bad idea to drop a tiny kitten among the pigeons. He laughed. "Well, Rust, Sybil's been banging on about me coming down here since young Sam was born, and this year she put her foot down, and I suppose an order from his wife must be considered official. When?" Vimes saw the man who pushed the enormous wheelchair trying to conceal a smile, especially when Rust responded with a baffled, "What?" Vimes decided not to go with "where," and instead, in an offhand way, said, "Well, you know how it is, Lord Rust. A policeman will find a crime anywhere if he decides to look hard enough." Lord Rust's smile remained, but it had congealed slightly as he said, "I should listen to the advice of your good lady, Vimes. I don't think you'll find anything worth your metal down here." There was no "what" to follow, and the lack of it was somehow an emphasis.
There's a lot more like that.
Yes.
I especially look forward to reading the Jane Austen bit.
I love the Jane Austen bit.
Do you want to do the Jane Austen bit?
No, I tell you what I do. I'll give it to Anne.
Well, I think that people might want to ask questions, and we haven't got that much.
Would you care to find the? Thank you. Yes, the Jane Austen bit. You had a lot of fun writing that, didn't you?
Yeah. The background to this is that Sybil's got lots of friends. Sybil is his wife. And one of them has, I think it's seven?
I think it's seven, yeah.
Seven girls, which she wants to marry off. And so there's a lot of balls involved. Now, I'm not a man to take advantage of this fact.
No, absolutely.
But to be honest, I'm sure she has lots of fans, and I very much liked her writing, but I couldn't stand a lot of Jane Austen when I was a kid. Mostly because I knew that my ancestors were probably going to be the farm workers. And in Jane Austen, no bugger ever does a hand's turn. They just keep on worrying about bloody bonnets.
Yeah.
And so the she's got the only girl. There's a seven. She's trying to get them. Mother is trying to get them seen off with men. And Hermione is going to be a big problem. Because she's a lumberjack. At which point Vimes says, it is a truth worth, a universal truth worth repeating, that a man with rolling acres is in want of a woman who can handle a great big chopper. Well, unfortunately, his wife stops him saying the last word, but I thought you were all grown up here.
At which point...
he gets slapped.
Yes, yeah. And Terry asked me, and it's worth racing to the end of the book for the bit at the end that always makes me laugh.
Yes, can we find a tree with a naughty name?
So Google was my friend. Rude trees. There's a lot of rude trees out there. Fantastic. And I'm not going to give you the name of the one that Terry chose, but
it just jumped out at you, as it were.
Yes, it, it did, in fact, yes. So if you like the Jane Austen bit, I think Anne is... I think it's quite early on. Anne's reading the whole book.
Awesome.
Awesome is a word that we're not allowed to use in
our office. Anyone got a question while the search is going on? Any old description?
Oh, there's the lady over there, the hand went up. Absolutely.
Could you talk a little about your documentary?
What, the death one?
Yeah.
How many of you saw it? Okay. Well, there. I mean, fairly soon we're going to be having to write some letters to the widow of the one man and the wife of another. That was a harrowing thing to do. I think it needed to be done. The BBC asked me to do it, and I did it. We did far more filming than ever went on, about 3, 4, 5 times more filming.
Oh, yeah.
And lots more interviews.
Does everyone know what the subject of the documentary was?
No.
Oh, right, okay. It was called Choosing to Die. It was about people...
I can go through it fairly quickly.
Mm.
There's an organisation called Dignitas in Switzerland. If you want to die, they help you die. Usually with a poison. A regrettable thing is... what is the poison?
Pentobarbital.
Mm. Actually, if you were on death row, you would have pentobarbital, mm-hmm. but you'd get something else as well, which would put you to sleep before it puts you to death. And when I watched the gentleman die, because we actually... Well, since I've been asked this, we have to go to Whole Hog. The BBC contacted people known to have been in touch with Dignitas, who were Brits, who were going to go, and said, you know, can we follow you on your journey? And everyone said yes. In fact, ones that, you know, I think there was about 20 involved. And they were really the ones, we could only choose two, and they were quite upset that we weren't doing it. And they wanted to die, usually all for the same reason, that they were possessed of a debilitating and very unpleasant illness for which there was no cure. There were quite a large variety of these. And our researcher chose two, and we did follow the journey of both of them and were present at the death of one of them, which is what we're really talking about here. He was a man called Peter, and he was an English gentleman, very well spoken. How English? We got on with him and his wife amazingly well.
Yes.
Bonding almost. You know, even though, you know, we are simply photographing what is going on. We can't really be involved. But at the same time, we love those guys.
Absolutely.
Because they were chatting. And the point is, oh, crikey. I mean, it comes back to me in a flood. We thought that probably we would follow them right up to the point where Peter and probably his wife went into the room where a very nice little lady, I will give him what she calls the medicament.
Yes.
And it's all done very properly. There's a camera overhead. And about three times, the biblical three times, he's asked whether he understands what he's doing, whether he understands that if he drinks this, it will kill him. And he answered yes to all of them. Because what wasn't shown in the documentary is that shortly after the police are called.
Yes.
Because it could always be possible that in some way this process could be used for committing an actual murder. Well, the police turned up shortly, and they were light police. They weren't particularly good. They weren't certainly weren't bad. It was a bit all in the job's a day's work. They spoke to the nice lady. They looked at the files, came up to us and said, BBC? And we said, yes. And said, OK.
And that was the only question left. They asked us. That was
because
the
BBC wouldn't get involved in anything wrong. We were the BBC, after all. And we flew BA.
This is on the tail end of the BBC getting in trouble for actually paying a piece of footage backwards that made it look as if the Queen was storming out of a room and she was walking in. And
it was harrowing in a way because I've seen dead bodies. I've seen mangled dead bodies in my career. But I was actually talking to Peter and actually joking with him and his wife before he stepped into the room and died. But he had, what was the one?
Motor
neuron disease. And it was just getting to the point where it was really getting unpleasant. There's no cure. He was a very rich man, extremely rich, houses all over the place.
Finest hotels
and a very rich family behind him. But he just did not wish to be a prisoner of a disease until he died. So he decided to leave before the end. And this was all new stuff for the crew and everybody. And I thought, well, I am a knight, and that's got to mean something. So I said to his wife, would you like me to come in with you? And she said, oh God, yes. Because she was a very English lady, a lady of the Shires. She said, well, you know, the Swiss accent is very Germanic, isn't it? And I don't quite feel that happy with it. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And I think, okay, I'm going to be sitting there watching a guy die. And then the day came, and because we'd seen them quite a few times, and we'd been in Switzerland for about 3 weeks, 3 days. And we were sort of, we've been looking at our watches. Oh, well, now. And they said, yes, all of you, come in. The cameraman, everybody, the sound man. Yeah. They were saying, come in. And then Peter, God bless him, after there were two potions. One is to stop you throwing up the first, which the body would actually throw up had you not given the first potion.
And it's vitally important to keep it down.
Yeah, and you have to keep it down. We were still sort of chatting to him, and then the lady came up, and here it was. And he said, well, thank you very much for this, he said. I'm very kind. I've been treated very kindly by you, and with everyone involved. And And he held out his hand and shook my hand and said, have a good life, I know I have. And he said the same thing to Rob. And then he was going around and thanking everybody by name. This is a man that's already drunk the hemlock, as it were. That's how he referred to it. But it wasn't taken. And then he got embarrassed because he couldn't remember the name of the sound guy. Oh, I'm really sorry. Of course, his name was Mike.
It's always Mike.
Because all sound men have the name Mike. It's the only word they can understand. And then he went and sat down next to his wife, in between his wife and the nurse, who was just, as it were, keeping a watchful eye, and died, making a rather guttural noise as he did so. And I can tell you that very few deaths are silent. The body goes on making noises even if the brain is no longer engaged. It takes quite a long time for the whole of a body to die, as any medic will tell you.
And the snow was falling.
Oh, yes, and the snow was falling. And outside, a man called Hurst, who was the husband of the nurse, and he had an Onkel Pieter pipe, the real old curly pipe, the fairy tale pipe. And he was walking backwards and forwards on the veranda in the snow, smoking his pipe, and the smoke was coming up through the snow, and it was like some Bergman film. And I realised why he wasn't inside, because to have a man smoking his pipe in a place where a man was dying was against health and safety. And it makes you want to laugh and cry and kill everybody. And then Peter died.
One thing I'm very proud about is that when you watch a lot of American documentaries, I'm sorry to say, you get the thing that comes up and it will say, certain scenes were filmed for the purposes of entertainment, okay? But with this one, everything that you saw, a good example would be when we first went to meet Peter and Christine, we were on the island of Guernsey. We had asked the crew 1,000 times who it was we were going to meet. And after a while, you can only ask so many times from various different angles before you realise they're not going to tell you. And the reason was they wanted the reaction to be completely genuine. And we always thought, certainly after we filmed the first documentary, that in fact, when you see people meeting for the first time over the doorway, they've been out for dinner the night before.
It is always the case.
It is always the case, yeah. They've been out for dinner the night before. You've at least met that morning and had breakfast with them. But with this documentary, everything you saw, when we first met Christine and Peter for the first time, we walked across, we had no idea who they were going to be.
But it instantly worked. First of all, approximately, they're the same age as me. Oh, no, about... A bit older.
Christine was about the same age, and Peter was a bit older.
Married for the same time as myself and my wife, Lynn, and with one child, a daughter, just like myself and Lynn. So instantly I bonded with them, and they were just so friendly in that middle English kind of way. Very good tea, I might point out, and showing us around the house and chatting to us as friends and making jokes.
I like the fact that we went out for lunch and we complimented them on what an excellent choice of restaurant, and it turned out to be their restaurant as well.
But did they own it?
I never realised it.
I thought they were just very, very friendly.
No, that was theirs. They owned that whole block with the apartments, the beautiful Art Deco apartments. It was absolutely fantastic. It was a pleasure to know them and...
It really was.
Yeah.
And the real bastard of this is that if you were Dutch, you could arrange, again, for medical reasons, an assisted death via your GP. If your GP would not help, then he would pass you on to the practitioners who would. And it was all done under a code of contract. And what's not shown on that particular movie was simply because we had time problems, we talked to one of the senior guys who oversaw the whole thing. You know, there was a lot of box ticking. How ill was the person? Were they compos mentis, which is obviously the most important thing. And we heard some very harrowing stories from him, some of which you probably couldn't even put on air. Especially about the screaming yellow skeleton will stay with me for some time. people in real extremis that really had to be let go free. Mm. And it took a lot of time, and it took a lot of out of all of us, all around that Christmas and afterwards, and right into the spring, didn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't think we'll ever. No, of course we won't. I said it's not even a question. We'll never forget it. It was such an.
But the thing was, there were two guys, a younger guy. We followed both, but we didn't follow the younger guy because we know even if we did, and he was all for it.
Oh yes.
And so was his family. Showing one death on television, you can say, yeah, that's public interest. Two is prurience, so we didn't.
You weren't surprised. On the night, when the night of broadcast, we were at the director's mother's house, and I was sitting next to the guy who composed the music for it, and I had my iPhone out, and I was following Twitter just to see what people thought of it, and I thought there might be one or two comments. And Terry was entirely not surprised by this, but I they were coming down more than one a second. They were coming down, you know, hundreds and hundreds, and I could not scroll fast enough to keep up with everything. And Terry wasn't surprised, but I was amazed that 99.9999% were in favour. And Terry's going, well, it's the commonality of mankind. Of course people are going to be in favour.
My father, he knew when he was dying. He had a year to know that he was dying. The doctor was very frank with him. Had a great big stent which kept him going. But they said, you've got about a year. Although they lied to him and my mum about, we just come to do your medications, which actually mean, in the end, kill you with morphine. I would have preferred if they had said, in the end, we're going to give you a shitload of morphine, which will make you feel very, very happy and then very, very dead. But it would be much better than what the disease would do. Because my dad was a practical person. And the world is not a good place for practical people to live in, because it's run by impractical ones. He said to me, if you see me sitting there with pipes and tubes in me and no further hope, then tell them to switch me off. I did, but they were big nurses, and I didn't want to fight them because this was in Wales at the time, and they were tough guys, tough girls. And I felt very ashamed about this, which is why I did the documentary, really.
So we've got just over 15 minutes left. That was an excellent question. No, there we are. You know, it just opens up a whole thing. We haven't spoken about it at all.
Elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But many people here have seen it. Wasn't it? Didn't it appear in the States?
No.
Well, I know that assisted dying, and you understand. I say assisted dying. It's not assisted suicide. Suicide is an irrational act. What coroners in England call, they usually say, so and so took their life while the balance of their mind was disturbed. In that case, they don't use the word suicide. It means the person was mentally ill. But the people that go for assisted dying in Oregon or wherever else are making a decision while they're compos mentis about the future. They're doing what a responsible person might be doing. That's why I hate it being called assisted suicide.
Absolutely. Would you like me to read the Jane Austen bit? Let's leave it on a high.
Let's bring them back to ground zero.
Yeah. It does knock it out of you. Even when we discuss it now, it really is as if it was just yesterday. It's
Crikey, doesn't it just?
Yeah, so it might take me a moment just to wind into this. I haven't read this out loud before, so do bear with me. Okay, so the introduction on this is that Vimes is at Ramkin Hall, Crundall's, and yet another tea party that Sybil has organised, and Vimes is there, and he's been told to be on his best behaviour.
This is at the home of girls and the mother who wants to get rid of them, more or less.
Okay, here we go. The rest of the day did not work out well. Vimes, suspicions filling his mind, was metaphorically and only just short of literally dragged by Sybil to see her friend Ariadne, the lady blessed with the six daughters. There we are.
Six,
what are we now, anyway?
It's a long time ago.
In actual fact, there were only five visible in the chintzy drawing room when Sybil and he were ushered in. He was feted as the dear, brave Commander Vimes. He hated that shit. But under Sybil's benign but careful gaze, he was wise enough not to say so, at least not in those precise words. And so he grinned and bore it while they fluttered around him like large moths, and he waved away yet more tea cakes and cups of tea that would have been welcome were it not that they looked and tasted like what proper tea turns into shortly after you drink it. As far as Sam Vimes was concerned, he liked tea, but tea was not tea if, even before drinking it, you could see the bottom of the cup. Still worse than the stuff he was being offered was the conversation, which inclined towards bonnets, a subject on which his ignorance was not just treasured, but venerated. And besides, his breeches were chafing, wretched things. But Sybil had insisted, saying that he looked very smart in them, just like a country gentleman. Vimes had to suppose that country gentlemen had different arrangements in the groinal department. There was, besides himself and Lady Sybil, a young Omnian curate, wisely dressed in a voluminous black robe, which presumably presented no groinal problems at all. Vimes had no idea why the young man was there, but presumably the young ladies needed somebody to fill with weak tea, suspect scones, and mindless twittering conversations when someone like Vimes wasn't there. And it seemed that when the subject of bonnets lost its fascination, the only other topics were legacies and the prospects for forthcoming balls. And so, inevitably, given his restlessness in female company, a growing disaffection for urine-coloured tea, and small talk that would barely be visible under a microscope, Vimes said, excuse me asking, ladies, but what is it that you actually do? I mean, for a living? This question elicited five genuinely blank looks. Vimes couldn't tell the daughters one from the other, except the one called Emily, who certainly lodged in the mind and possibly also in doorways, and who now said, in the tones of one slightly out of her depth, I do beg your pardon, Commander, but I don't think we understand what you just vouchsafed. I meant, how do you make a living? Are any of you in employment? How do you make your daily crust? What work do you do? Vimes could pick up nothing from Sybil because he couldn't see her face, but the girl's mother was staring at him with gleeful fascination. Oh, well, if he was going to get it in the neck, he might as well get it all the way down. I mean, ladies, he said, how do you make your way in the world? How do you earn your keep? Apart from bonnets, do you have any skills, like cookery, for example? Another daughter, quite possibly Mavis, but Vimes was guessing, cleared her throat and said, fortunately, Commander, we have servants for that sort of thing. We're gentlewomen, you see. It would be quite unthinkable for us to go into trade or commerce. Oh, the scandal, it's just not done. By now, there appeared to be a competition to see who could terminally baffle who, or possibly whom, first. But Vimes managed to say, don't you have a sister in the timber business? It was amazing, he thought, that neither their mother nor Sybil was as yet adding anything to the conversation. And now another sister, possibly Amanda, looked about to speak. Why in the world did they all wear those silly diaphanous dresses? You couldn't hope to do a day's work in something as skimpy as that. Amanda, possibly, said carefully, I'm afraid our sister is a bit of an embarrassment to the family, Your Grace. What, for getting a job? Another one of the girls, and Vimes was in fact getting really confused at this point, said, "Well, Commander, she has no hope of making a good marriage now. Not to a gentleman." This was becoming a tangle, and so Vimes said, "Tell me, ladies, what is a gentleman?" After some whispered conversations, a sacrificial daughter said very nervously, "We understand the gentleman is a man who does not have to sully his hands by working. Adamantium is said to be the strongest of all metals, but it would have bent around the patience of Sam Vimes as he said, with every syllable carefully smelted, 'Oh, a layabout.'" "And how do you go about snagging such a gentleman, pray?" Now the girls looked as if they were indeed praying. One of them managed to say, "You see, Commander, our dear late father was unlucky in the money markets, and I'm afraid that until the death of Great Aunt Marigold, of whom we have expectations, there is, alas, no money for a dowry for any of us." The heavens held their breath while the concept of a dowry was explained to Sam Vimes. And ice formed on the windows as he sat in strangulated thought. At last he cleared his throat and said, "Ladies, the solution to your problem, in my opinion, would be to get off your quite attractive backsides and go out there in the world and make your own way. A dowry? You mean some man has to be paid to marry you? What century do you think you're living in? Is it just me, or is it the most bloody stupid thing you could ever imagine?" He glanced at the beautiful Emily and thought, "Good grief, men would line up on the lawn to fight one another. My dear, how come no one's ever told you? Gentility is all very well, but practicality has its uses. Get out in the world and let the world see you, and it might find a new word in its vocabulary, such as perhaps, wow." Aloud, he continued, "Honestly, there's lots of jobs out there for a young lady with her wits about you. The Lady Sybil Free Hospital is always on the lookout for sharp girls to train as nurses, for example. Good pay, very fetching uniforms, and a fine chance of snagging a skilled young physician who's on his way to the top, especially if you get your boot behind him. Plus, of course, as a nurse, you inherit an amazingly large amount of amusing and embarrassing stories about things that people put up there." Sorry. Perhaps this is not the time, but anyway... "There's also the possibility of becoming a matron if you reach the specified weight." "A very responsible job of use to the community at large and giving you at the end of a long day the satisfaction that you've done something good to the world." Vimes looked around at the pink and white faces contemplating a jump into the unknown and continued, "Of course, if you really want to stick with bonnets, then Sybil and I own a decent property up in Old Cobblers in the big city, which is standing empty at the moment. Used to be a tough area, but the upwardly mobile trolls and vampires are moving in right now. And the heavy dollar and the dark dollar are not to be sneezed at, especially because they'll pay top dollar for what they want. Quite a sophisticated area too. People actually put tables and chairs out on the pavements and they don't always get stolen. We could let you have it rent-free for 3 months to see how you do, and then maybe you'd have to learn the concept of rent, if only for your own self-respect. Trust me, ladies, self-respect is what you get when you don't have to spend your life waiting for some rich old bird to pop her clogs. Any takers?" Vimes took as an optimistic sign the fact that the girls were staring at one another with what could only be called a wild surmise at the prospect of not being totally useless ornaments. And so he added, "And whatever you do, stop reading bloody silly romantic novels." There was, however, a pocket, or possibly a purse, of resistance to the revolution. One girl was standing by the curate as if she owned him. She looked at Vimes defiantly and said, Please, don't think me forward, Commander, but I'd rather like to marry Jeremy and help him in his ministry." Very good," said Vimes. "And you love him and he loves you? Speak up, the pair of you." They both nodded, red with embarrassment, each with one eye on the girl's mother, whose wide grin suggested that would be a definite plus. "Well then, I suggest you get yourself sorted out, and you, young man, would be advised to find a better paying job. Can't help you with that, but there's loads of religions out there these days." And if I were you, I'd impress some bishop somewhere with my common sense, which is what a clergyman needs above everything else. Oh, well, nearly everything else. And remember, there's always room at the top, although in the case of religion, not right at the top, eh? Vimes thought for a moment and added, but maybe the best idea, ladies, might be to take a look around a bit until you find some lad that's got the makings of a successful man, noble or not. And if he suits, then get behind him, support him as necessary, help him up when he's down, and generally be around when he looks for you, and make certain that he'll be around when you look for him. Well, if both of you put your backs into it, then it might turn out to be something good. It certainly worked once before, didn't it, Sybil? Sybil burst out laughing, and the overwhelmed girls nodded dutifully as if they actually understood. But Vimes was gratified to feel a gentle prod from Lady Sybil that offered hope that he was not going to pay too high a price from his wife for speaking his mind to these precious flowers. He looked around as if seeking to tidy things up. Well, that seems to be that, yes? Excuse me, Commander. It took Vimes some time to see where the voice had come from. This daughter hadn't spoken a word all afternoon, but had occasionally scribbled in a notebook. Now she gazed at him with what looked like a somewhat brighter smile than the rest of her sisters. Can I help you, miss? And perhaps you'll tell me your name? Jane, Commander. I am endeavouring to be a writer. May I ask if you have any views on whether that's an acceptable career for a young lady? Jane, thought Vimes, the strange one. And she was. She was just as demure as the other sisters, but somehow, as he looked at her, he got the impression that she was seeing right through him, thoughts and all. Vimes leaned back in his chair, a little defensively, and said, well, it can't be a difficult job, given that all the words have probably been invented already. So there's a saving in time right there. Considering that you simply have to put them together in a different order. That was about the limit of his expertise in the literary arts. But he added, what sort of thing were you thinking of writing, Jane? The girl looked embarrassed. Well, Commander, at the moment I'm working on what might be considered a novel about the complexities of personal relationships with all their hopes and dreams and misunderstandings. She coughed nervously as if apologising. Vimes pursed his lips. Yes, sounds basically like a good idea, miss, but I can't really help you on that. Though if I was you, and this is me talking off the top of my head, I'd be putting in a lot of fighting and dead bodies falling out of wardrobes. And maybe a war, perhaps, as a bit of a background? Jane nodded uneasily. Oh, a remarkable suggestion, Commander, with much to recommend it, but possibly the relationships would be somewhat neglected. Vimes considered this input and said, well, you might be right. Then, out of nowhere, possibly some deep hole, a thought struck him, just as it had many times before, sometimes in nightmares. I wonder if any author has thought about the relationship between the hunter and the hunted, the policeman and the mysterious killer, the lawman who must think like a criminal sometimes in order to do his job, and maybe unpleasantly surprised at how good he is at such thinking. You know, perhaps, just an idea, you understand? He said lamely, and wondered where the hell that had come from. Maybe the strange Jane had pulled it out of him, and even, perhaps, could resolve it. Would anybody like some more tea? Said Ariadne brightly. Lady Sybil was very quiet as their coach drove away, and so Vimes decided to bite the bullet now and get it over with. She was looking thoughtful, which was always worrying. Am I in trouble, Sybil? His wife looked at him blankly for a moment and then said, you mean for telling that bunch of precious blooms to stop yearning for a life and to get out there and make one? Good heavens, no! You did everything I would have expected of you, Sam. You always do. I told Ariadne you wouldn't let her down. She doesn't have much of an income, and if you hadn't given them the righteous word, I think she would have eventually driven them out with a shovel.
Because the book is now out, so some of you already know it, that is why, about 1 year later, there is a book which is, in fact, dedicated to Commander Sir Samuel Vimes.
That's it.
And it's called Pride and Extreme Prejudice. I really am pleased with that one.
Yeah. The final bit was, Sybil just continued. No, Sam, I just wonder what goes in your head, that's all. I mean, I'm not sure some people think being a policeman is just a job, but you don't, do you? I'm very proud of you, Sam. I wouldn't have you any other way, but I do worry sometimes. Anyway, well done. I look forward with interest to see what young Jane writes. So there you are, that's that. During the day, I can't help laughing out loud an awful lot, okay? But Terry always surprises me because a scene's going really well and I'm laughing along with it. And then Terry drops the line in that actually means that I have to step outside the office because I'm actually going to die if I don't. And
my favourite bit. You're just bunking off early. <That's>,
but my favourite one is that Sam Vimes is in a huge bath in Rampkin Hall, and he's under the bubbles, and he's conversing with Sybil. They're having a nice chat, and Sybil takes off her bathrobe and slips into the water. And Terry said, the bubbles rose, as did Sam Vimes's spirits. And I had to go away for a bit on that one. And that was it, because Terry ended the scene and everything else was just left for you, the reader, as it was left for me. It was like, oh, God, that was great. Yeah, thank you for that.
Brevity is the soul of wit.
Yes, it is, absolutely. One of our favourite pieces of grammar is the ellipsis, and we order them in daily.
Yeah, sometimes we make our own, because the ones you make at home... They're a lot better than the ones shop bought.
And Terry makes me stick them in like that. And if I mess them up, then I use one of the dots as a semicolon and things. So it's the recyclable school of literature, Terry tells me. So there you are. We've got to head off in a minute, unfortunately, because we've got to head back to the UK. But thank you for the... I mean, it was the one question, but thank you for that. And that was some... We could probably sit here all afternoon talking about that. And if I had 8 hours, I'd probably sit here and read the rest of this to you. Because I love it so much. And you can, I hope you can tell that that's actually from the heart. I'm not sitting here saying, go out and buy it, because I assume most of you will. I love it.
Yeah. And the reason for us being so definite about going is we've got about a day and a half's time to get out of the jet lag before we do this whole circus again in England, only even heavier.
Yeah, the Theatre Royal Drury Lane, where I last watched two of the river dancers doing their stuff. When the publishers told us that we would be there, you think, okay, well, Terry filled the Sydney Opera House, and it was just... And I'm okay, I'm not allowed to use the word awesome, as Terry will tell you.
No, I'll tell you why.
Yep.
Stop using the word awesome. Unless God and Satan actually go into battle in front of your eyes. A really good cup of coffee is a really good cup of coffee. It is not awesome. So if you're going to keep... Sorry? What is awesome?
But the,
well, you have to have... There has to be some kind of a scale, you know. If a cup of coffee can be awesome, what is the universe?
Wicked awesome.
God bless America. Actually, I hope, because you're fans, you understand what I really mean. Because I invent stuff all the time. But I just, you know, I rather treasure the English language even when it's the American language. And if you treat it with respect, you get more fun sometimes, or actually, with carefully calculated disrespect.
But the Sydney Opera House, I did walk out and I couldn't help but uttering the word awesome, because you were there with Garth Nix, and there was little old me about to read to 2,500 people in the Sydney Opera. It was incredible. So when they told us it was Theatre Royal Drury Lane in London, that also holds that awesomeness for two British blokes.
Not awesome.
All right, great, kind of great.
Kind of
greatness.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Impressive stuff.
Yeah,
well done, that man.
There you go.
A pedant.
But it was 2,500 people, and you think, well, in Sydney, they don't get to see Terry much, so that's fine. line. And on the day of the show, they had more people waiting in reserve than for tickets they'd already sold. And they asked Terry if they could open it up. So Terry was sitting in the round. So in other words, they were sitting behind you as well as in front. So we knew that it was a great gig.
You've got time to tell them about the teeth.
Oh, the teeth, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. That took up about half of the gig, actually.
It's going to take us some time to have to explain that. How much time have we really got?
About 40 seconds. Yeah, we actually have none, yeah, yeah.
Plastic teeth from Hogfather. We had a load of them. We had millions. Many of you must have them. If you haven't, every fan in the world will have some of the plastic teeth. And we took the last lot to Sydney because we couldn't get rid of them. And because it was in the round, it was ever so weird. I think the whole thing ended with me in the swivel chair going round and round, throwing plastic teeth at the audience and saying, careful, some of them are sharp.
Yes. They had to read out a health and safety warning before you did it.
Yeah.
So we're back off to London to do Drury Lane, of which I knew 2,500 people in London where, you know, Terry, we don't get out as much as we used to. Of course, happily, you're writing all the time. But to another, we're going to be sitting in there, and there'll be my mum and my dad and Lynn, and maybe a few other people might be interested to go. So when we got a call from a fan the other day who always assumes he's going to get a freebie, and we have no complimentary tickets, and he wrote to us to say, I can't get a ticket because it's sold out. That was quite awesome as well, actually.
All right, it was awesome.
It was awesome. So, yeah, I'm going to leave it on an awesome because we do have to run to Dallas, yeah. Unfortunately. So that was for you. Before my mic is switched off, we're giving this to you. So I don't know what you're going to do with it. So. I think it's going to go into the auction or something, so I'll give it to somebody. So there you are. Thank you.
Hello.